is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. On Monday, the FDA fully approved Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for people ages 16 and older. And President Joe Biden took this moment to address vaccine hesitancy.
If you're one of the millions of Americans who said that they will not get the shot until it has full and final approval of the FDA, it has now happened. The moment you've been waiting for is here. It's time for you to go get your vaccination and get it today. Today.
Today. A poll released by the Kaiser Family Foundation at the end of June found that 3 out of 10 unvaccinated adults said they'd be more likely to get vaccinated if the FDA granted its full approval to one of the vaccines. But the more wide-reaching impact of the FDA approval is that employers and schools are likely to be emboldened by the agency's decision. The Pentagon said on Monday that it will be moving forward with a vaccine mandate for active duty troops. And officials in New York City announced a vaccine mandate for public school employees as well. And amid all of this news, we know that many of you have questions about the vaccines. So we're going to start today off by bringing you some answers. Here to help me provide those answers is Sikon Akpan, who is health and science editor for the WNYC Newsroom. Sikon, great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Melissa. Appreciate it.
Okay, over 200 million doses of Pfizer vaccine. They've already been administered in the U.S. Why did the FDA need until this week to fully approve the vaccine?
Yeah, so, you know, Pfizer filed for a full approval back in early May for what's called a biologics license that basically launched a process where the FDA visited a bunch of clinical trial sites to conduct a massive data audit. You know, so they physically went there and made sure that nothing funny happened during the trials in terms of the data collection. And we're not just talking about looking at, you know, data summaries. You know, they really went down to the individual patients. And we're talking about 22,000 people in a trial. They followed about 12,000 in terms of safety for at least 6 months. So that's a lot of individual data. And then they also physically visited Pfizer's manufacturing lines to make sure that doses are prepared under the highest quality standards. So Peter Marks, the director of the FDA Center for Biologics Evaluation and Research, who was in charge of this licensing process, said that they completed a process that would normally take about 8 months and just over 3 months. And I think people may hear that and think that, oh no, they rushed it. But, you know, this type of analysis is just about crunching data so you can physically push through it if you have enough hours. And it sounded like the FDA team hasn't really slept in the past few months.
They put all of the human hours on it. So how, you know, it's interesting as you say that sort of the speed with which they moved, right, which was critical given that we're in a global pandemic, might also still somehow undermine trust. And so part of what I'm interested in here is whether or not even for those 3 in 10 Americans, this FDA full approval really will have the effect of increasing vaccinations.
Yeah. So, you know, looking at surveys that have been conducted by KFF, or formerly known as the Kaiser Family Foundation, you know, we've seen since the vaccines were first authorized, about 13% of the country saying, oh, you know, I'm definitely not going to get the vaccine. And like, that's just been solid throughout ever since then. But, you know, there's this other group called the wait and see group. And, you know, that group made up about, you know, 40%, 45% of people when the vaccines were first authorized back in December. But over time, we've sort of seen that come down and down, down and down and down. You know, that could be due to better access. You know, the rollout just sort of improved over time. It could be due to people's comfort levels. You know, the hesitant saying like, oh, I'm just going to go get this vaccine because it seems like it's safe and effective. My friends got it. You know, my doctor's telling me to get it. My pastor's telling me to get it. And so we're seeing that wait and see group shrink over time. And hopefully, you know, with this approval, even more people will get the vaccine. We'll see it shrink further.
I want to listen to a call from Julia in Portland, who is interested not only in this question of sort of whether or not people make a different choice, but specifically here about the idea of mandates. Let's take a listen.
Will mandates actually help increase the level of vaccination? Are vaccine mandates legal? I think we need to do whatever is necessary to get to a level of immunity that finally stops the spread of the COVID-19 virus and prevents unnecessary deaths from the disease and its complications.
So what should Julia know about vaccine mandates?
Yeah, I suspect that the mandates will improve vaccination rates. So, you know, the surveys that I mentioned from KFF, they found that there's this other group that says I'll only get the vaccine if required. And, you know, that started about 10% in last December, and it's gradually shrunken over time. And so I think now that you're seeing more mandates come through with the full approval, you know, yesterday we saw it from New Jersey, we saw it from New York City, we saw the state school system in New York and Minnesota. I think Louisiana State also mandated the vaccines. You know, I think we're going to see a lot more companies, a lot more public organizations mandating it. And so I would think that the vaccination rates would improve through that.
So as you were talking about the various groups, the kind of I'm never going to get it, the wait and seers, you also sort of mentioned the accessibility question. Do we have a sense right now the extent to which accessibility rather than hesitancy is that sort of is causing the group that is not vaccinated?
I can speak to New York City in that regard. And I would say in New York City, we don't have a great sense of how much hesitancy is at play versus access. You know, we've been pushing the mayor and his officials to release what's called the COVID vaccine inventory list, which would tell us exactly where vaccine doses were delivered, you know, how many went into each neighborhood, into each zip code. And that would give us a really great picture of access. And then we could say, yes, you know, you did distribute these doses evenly based on population or based on income level. The city has been really hesitant to give that data to us, even though at one point the mayor said that he would give it to us. On the flip side, you know, there has been a lot of talk about hesitancy. Looking at national surveys that were conducted by Health and Human Services, the hesitancy rates in New York City actually are among the lowest in the country. And the same actually applies to New York. And that makes sense, right? You know, we've been one of the leaders in doling out these vaccines. And so if you look at the difference between like Manhattan and Brooklyn in those surveys, there's only about a 2% difference in hesitancy rates. I think it's like 8% versus 6%. But then if you look at the division in terms of the number of people who are vaccinated, you know, Manhattan has a 20%, I guess, more coverage than Brooklyn, which tells me that, yeah, maybe Brooklyn is more hesitant, or maybe there's something going on with, you know, the number of mass vaccination sites in Brooklyn, the number of small vaccination sites and like mobile clinics in Brooklyn. And I would love to get that data from the city so that way we can answer that question.
Any sense in your hypothesis around this that race, ethnicity, language barriers might be part of this, immigration status?
Yeah, you know, early on, we saw some pretty big gaps in terms of race and vaccine coverage. But lately, we've seen those gaps shrink. So right now in New York City, about 47% of white New Yorkers are fully vaccinated. Looking at Hispanic and Latino populations, it's 45%, so pretty close. You look at Black populations, it's further behind, it's 33%. But back in February, you know, those gaps were much larger. They're very, very big. I think the other thing it's kind of interesting in the data right now is that, you know, we're really having an issue getting past like 50%, 60% coverage. Like, we've really hit the ceiling. And so I think that's a place where the mandates might come into play in terms of increasing vaccination rates. Because if you have to do it in order to go back to work or to go to restaurants, to go to Broadway, you know, it's going to sort of create a social norm around the vaccine that will potentially increase vaccination rates.
So clearly it was the Pfizer vaccine that gained full approval, but many Americans have Moderna. So let's listen to a call here from Frank from Glendale, who has a question about that.
I'm calling to ask, when is Moderna being fully approved? And are we able to compare the Pfizer and Moderna vaccine? And also, are the two comparable? Are they more like apples or oranges, or are they more like navel oranges to juice oranges?
Yeah, I like that orange.
I know, right? It was good. Frank is good.
So yesterday, it sounded as if Moderna hasn't actually filed for a full approval yet. That's what Director Marks said from the FDA. You know, these companies, I think, are sort of jockeying for positions. So, you know, Pfizer was sort of first out of the gate, and they were able to amass enough data to get this full approval for people over 16. You know, Moderna might be saying, oh, like, we're just going to try to collect all the data we can for the adolescents to adults, so 12 and up, and then maybe we'll apply for the full approval, or maybe they're going to apply with 5 and up, right? They're just going to go for the whole shebang. But right now, it sounds like Moderna hasn't filed for a full approval, so the timeline is a little unclear.
So some folks are hesitant, and some of us are like, when can I get my third, fourth, and fifth vaccine shot? So let's take a listen to some questions about booster shots.
I'm wondering what the best way is to get the booster shot. Should I go to my primary physician? Will there be community vaccination centers? Or is there something else that will be offered to the general public? It just seems like there's a lot of uncertainty around this whole issue right now.
So what should people know about this process?
Yeah, the uncertainty may result from the fact that the federal plan for booster shots for everyone actually hasn't been approved yet. So the FDA and the CDC still need to, I guess, figure out the plan and ratify the plan. The only people who can get booster shots right now are actually the immunocompromised. And those folks can go anywhere you can get a vaccine. So, you know, you might want to consult with your doctor first, but once you can sort of show like, hey, I'm immunocompromised, then you can go get the vaccine. But for everybody else, we're sort of in a wait and see moment in terms of the boosters. And I think the other thing that people should know is even before the boosters were approved for immunocompromised people, I think there are like 1.1 million people had already gotten unauthorized booster shots. You know, I think that's less of a risk for adults. But you are kind of flying into a Bermuda Triangle in terms of what we know about the safety of the vaccines. So, you know, you want to, we know with like, you know, the first and second doses of Pfizer, Moderna, for instance, that you want to wait 3 to 4 weeks in order to be perfectly safe, right? In order to be perfectly safe. If you're taking a booster at some unknown time after your second dose, it's hard to say like how that dose might behave in terms of like even generating protection against the virus. So we really should wait for the guidelines from the CDC and FDA before starting to seek those booster shots.
Oh, that's super helpful. One more really critical question for all of us who are parents with children under 12. Let's listen to this call from Rebecca in South Carolina.
What I'd like to know is when parents can anticipate vaccines for children 5 and over. As a parent in South Carolina that prohibits mandatory masking in public schools, we've got legislators who refuse to follow the CDC and AAP guidelines. Being able to protect my kindergarten-age child feels impossible without a vaccine available for children.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating to hear, you know, people sort of rejecting the use of masks when, like, we've really been able to show that they help protect against the spread of the virus. But in terms of vaccine approvals for kids under 12, essentially that authorization could happen anytime between now and the beginning of next year. That's sort of been the timeline that was outlined by the FDA. You know, the drug companies will have to apply for those authorizations, and then I imagine that once they do, they'll go through pretty quickly. But, you know, the thing I like to remind people about when they ask this question is that we actually don't need to vaccinate kids from 5 to 12. You know, if we could get the vaccination rates high enough in adults, it would naturally drive down the spread of the virus to such a degree that it wouldn't be able to get into children. You know, a lot of the studies that we've looked at have shown that the virus often spreads from adults into children. So if we could just break transmission in adults, we would be able to protect those young kids. But, you know, I think in the reality of the United States, we've had real struggles with getting adults to want to protect themselves from disease and death during this pandemic. And it is extremely frustrating. And so, yeah, we're sort of in limbo right now in terms of the timing on the authorization for kids under 12.
All right, adults, do you hear that? We can form a vaccine wall around our young people to protect them, because right now they do not have an option to get the vaccine. Sikhan Akpan is the health and science editor for the WNYC Newsroom. Sikhan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The Delta variant of COVID-19 is hitting hard in the southern United States. Alabama has seen a 59% increase in hospitalizations over the past 2 weeks, with ICUs at 100% capacity. But in a state with the lowest vaccination rate in the nation, even former President Donald Trump was recently booed for recommending the shot.
I recommend take the vaccines. I did it. It's good. Take the vaccines. But you got, no, that's okay. That's all right. You got your freedoms.
To help us understand what's happening in Alabama, we're joined today by Sarah Nafzinger, who is Vice President of Clinical Support Services at the University of Alabama Hospital. Dr. Nafzinger, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So can you talk a little bit about how this current wave compares to previous waves in the state of Alabama?
Yeah, you know, this wave of cases, we've really seen an increase that's much faster than we saw in the previous surges. And I think that's something that's really taken our healthcare workers by surprise. And the other thing that's really different about this wave is that our patients are much younger. In the previous wave, the average age of our patients who were admitted was 65 years old. And in this wave, our average age of patients is 55. So we're seeing a switch to younger patients. Now, you know, we asked ourselves why that might be, and we think it's because we actually do have a pretty good vaccination rate in our older population. So they tend to have more protection. And so we think that's why we're really seeing this surge in more younger patients who are being hospitalized. But, you know, the other things that are really different about this surge is that our staff is really exhausted. You know, we've been dealing with this for a year and a half, and they're just tired. You know, prior to this surge, we were already struggling to staff the hospital, not only with nurses, we talk about nurses a lot, but with all the support staff, the environmental services, food and nutrition, guest services, all the other positions that are so critical to patient care. And so we were already weakened going into this surge. And now our staff is just feeling completely exhausted. And we're starting to see a lot of absenteeism, not only from staff members being infected, but having to stay home because their children have been infected. You know, school started here a couple of weeks ago, and the vast majority of our school systems are not requiring masking. So we're seeing a lot of people who have children who are out sick or out with quarantines, and it's really impacting our staff. So definitely this surge has been the most difficult for us to manage so far in the pandemic.
Can you help us to understand something about what's going on with such a low vaccination rate in the state overall? It's really helpful to hear that that, you know, maybe the elderly, the older population does have a decent vaccination rate. Also really helpful to hear that part of what may be going on with this surge is not just being without vaccines, but being maskless in the relatively concentrated environment of schools. But as you're talking to families, as you're talking to patients, do you have a sense of why only just over a third of residents of Alabama are vaccinated?
You know, that's the million-dollar question that we're all asking ourselves and really struggling with right now, because when the vaccine was first available, you know, we were in healthcare sector very excited. You know, it was the miracle that we had all been praying for, and it arrived. And we were just astonished when our vaccination rates tapered off. And we've done a lot of, you know, a lot of focus groups and had a lot of conversations about why the vaccination rates are so low. And it's really multifactorial. And what it boils down to are several things. The first one is, you know, a lot of misinformation is out there about the safety of the vaccine. And people looked a lot to social media and other resources for their news. And it's really difficult, I think, for people to distinguish real news and real science from something that might be misinformation. So a lot of concerns about pregnancy and fertility, a lot of concerns about some of the more outlandish things, like, you know, is this going to inject a microchip into me? Is it going to magnetize me? Is it going to change my DNA? So there's a lot of that misinformation out there.
Do you want to answer real quick the questions about being magnetized? I mean, and I don't mean to be silly here, but genuinely, if those are concerns, and maybe most importantly, the fertility concern.
Yeah, you know, the big one is the fertility concern. You know, all the other things that seem so outlandish to us, you know, it's really quick to just dismiss and say, you know, there's no evidence that this vaccine will magnetize you. There's no microchip. You know, there's no way that this alters your DNA because of the science of how they work. But the pregnancy and fertility one, I think, is a big one that people need to hear. There's absolutely no data that shows that these vaccines compromise your pregnancy, that they cause any adverse outcomes with pregnancy or fertility. In fact, COVID is much worse. People who have COVID who are pregnant have terrible outcomes compared to people who don't have COVID. And so really, you know, trying to get that word out that there are big studies and lots of pregnant women that show that the vaccines don't cause any increase in adverse events. But in fact, pregnant women who get COVID have a much worse outcome than pregnant women who don't get COVID. So, you know, trying to get that information out there has just been a heavy lift for us. And people still just don't trust what they see. And I think that really leads to the big reason why people are not getting vaccinated here. And it's simple. It's mistrust. They don't trust the government. They don't always trust the healthcare sector. You know, they say, hey, you've told me last year, you know, X, Y, and Z, and, you know, you came back and said something different now. And trying to explain that, hey, well, we say something different now because we learned something different. That's science. You know, we study things, we learn new things, and we change our recommendations based on the new things that we've learned. A lot of people really have a hard time with that. And it's been difficult, particularly here, to overcome that mistrust.
I so appreciate that because I get that. I get why that can feel hard. I can remember feeling that way myself early on around the masking recommendations. Thank you so much, not only for joining us today, but for your continued work on the ground there in Alabama. I know it's tough times, and I hope that both you and your staff are able to hold up through this. Dr. Sarah Nafzinger is Vice President of Clinical Support Services at the University of Alabama Hospital. Dr. Nafzinger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We turn now to Oklahoma, where Julius Jones is still on death row. In July of 1999, businessman Paul Howell was shot and killed during a carjacking in Edmond, Oklahoma. At the time of the murder, Julius Jones was an honor student at the University of Oklahoma. He was 19 years old, and he had an alibi, which was never presented in court. Instead, Julius Jones was convicted in a trial, where he was defended by an attorney with no prior experience with capital cases. Jones was sentenced to death, and he has now lived more of his life incarcerated and awaiting execution than he spent as a free person. But Jones has consistently maintained his innocence, while the state continues to insist he is guilty. It's worth noting that only two states in the country have executed more people than Oklahoma, and that Oklahoma is among the top five worst counties for wrongful convictions. In addition, the state Supreme Court halted executions 6 years ago after two brutal executions in 2014. In January of 2014, as Michael Lee Wilson was put to death by lethal injection, he cried out that his whole body was burning. And just a few months later, Clayton Lockett was tortured to death by the state of Oklahoma during a 43-minute botched execution. Julius Jones has exhausted his appeals. And on September 13th, the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board will hear Julius Jones' request for commutation. With me now is Reverend C.C. Jones Davis, the campaign founder and director of Justice for Julius. Reverend Jones Davis, welcome.
Thank you so much, Melissa. Thank you and for just having us today. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. Tell me how you got involved in the fight to clear Julius's name.
Yes. So I was living in Oklahoma when the Last Defense, a docuseries that Ms. Viola Davis and Mr. Julius Tenen produced for ABC, when it aired, and that was 2018. I'm not from Oklahoma, and I had never, when I moved there, I had never heard anything about Julius Jones. But when I saw this documentary, I was so many things. I was enraged. I was heartbroken. And there was just no way morally that I was going to be able to live in Oklahoma, pay taxes in Oklahoma, and not say something, not do something. And so I contacted his attorneys who are based in Arizona, and his family, the Jones family, who are still in Oklahoma City. And here we are today, 3 or 4 years later, with a massive movement that I believe God has just really blessed.
Now, the state of Oklahoma says that this massive movement is a massive misinformation and disinformation campaign. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, listen, I think that the state of Oklahoma prides itself in believing that people will continue to believe the words of white men in power over the words of everyday people like me, over the words of poor and incarcerated people like Julius Jones, everyday people like the Jones family. And I think people today are a lot smarter and understand that the criminal justice system, not just in Oklahoma, but across the country, is broken. And so I think Oklahoma has gone to great lengths to silence us, to discredit the things that we have said. But, you know, I don't know how you discredit 3-4 individuals who come forward not knowing each other to say another man has confessed to this crime over and over again. I don't know how the state thinks it can discredit that. And that's one issue that they have not addressed. And these were the problems that were highlighted in The Last Defense. And I do want to invite people to watch it at justiceforjulius.com. You can watch what I watched and feel the rage and understand why so many of us are passionate about this. But Julius did not have a proper defense. Julius had an attorney who passed away right before trial. And so he was given public defenders who were overwhelmed and underqualified, who had never tried a capital case a day in their lives. One of the attorneys on the team had just passed the bar exam. And these people are on The Last Defense saying, listen, we were well over our heads. These folks did not call a single witness to the stand. So when it was their turn, Melissa, in court, they literally stood up and said, we rest, and sat back down. They did not call an alibi, which was the members of the Jones family who say that Julius was sitting right there on the sofa with them eating spaghetti and cornbread and a birthday cookie that night, watching the news about the shooting. They did not present one. They did not cross-examine well. They just did not do their job at all. And as a result, largely a man is sitting today on death row for the last 22 years. Julius did not have a jury of his peers. There was one person of color on that jury. Also, some years later, a white juror came forward to say that another white juror at the time of the trial said, let's just take this N-word to the back of the court and shoot him. This is a waste of our time. That juror remained on the jury and, of course, voted for his conviction and for his death. So there are so many issues with Julius's case. You know, Julius didn't fit the description. The only eyewitness, who was the sister to the victim, says that this was an African-American man with a bandana across his face, a scully on his head, and at least a half an inch of hair hanging from underneath the cap. Well, there are pictures that show 9 days before the crime, Julius had a very close cut. Not enough hair to pick up. I mean, close to his head cut. He didn't have enough hair to stick from underneath a cap. But his co-defendant, Christopher Jordan, the man who has confessed over and over again, did have braids, enough braid to stick from underneath a cap. All of this has been just obviously really, really troubling to me and thousands of people across this country.
So I can hear the distress in your voice. How is Julius feeling now as he's facing this kind of appeal of last resort to the commutation board?
I think Julius is feeling really hopeful. He is so overwhelmed by the amount of support that he has gotten over the last few years. He's so grateful And he's looking toward the future. He's able now to at least have a dream about what his life could potentially be after all of this, if it goes the way that we want it to go and that it needs to go. And I'm looking forward to Julius having an opportunity to talk to young kids, to mentor. That's really important to him. And that's something he's actually been doing from death row for many years, mentoring kids. So he's hopeful, you know, but we are all, the folks that are working on this team, we're cautiously optimistic. No death row inmate in Oklahoma has ever received a commutation hearing. And so this is historical in its own right, but we need the pardon and parole board members, those five human beings, and then the governor, Governor Stitt, to look at the merits of this and to say enough is enough and to bring Julius home to his mom and dad.
Reverend C.C. Jones Davis, the campaign founder and director of Justice for Julius. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for sharing the story behind the movement to free Julius Jones. And please know we will continue to report on this story and to keep our eyes on it. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Jeopardy.
I'll take a host of problems for $200.
9 days after he was announced as the new host of Jeopardy, this game show executive stepped down amid lots of controversy.
Who is Mike Richards?
Correct.
That's right. Richards, who is the executive producer of Jeopardy, was recently named host of the beloved quiz show. But after an article from The Ringer revealed offensive and misogynistic comments made by Richards as host of a podcast called The Random Show, Richards announced he would be stepping aside from the hosting role. He remains the show's EP. Now, a new search for a permanent host will begin. And again, with guest hosts returning to fill in for the new season. Actor slash neuroscientist Mayim Bialik, who was named the host of the show's primetime specials, will now be stepping in to host the weekday show, at least for the next 3 weeks. For more on this, I spoke with Claire McNear, staff writer at The Ringer, and author of Answers in the Form of Questions, A Definitive History and Insider's Guide to Jeopardy. I started out by asking Claire about how she came by this story.
I wrote a book about Jeopardy, and I've been reporting on Jeopardy at The Ringer for a few years now, intermittently, and have gotten to know a lot of people in that world. So I've been writing a lot about the show over the past year since the death of Alex Trebek, and writing about the guest hosts and the search for a new permanent host. So after a couple of weeks ago, when it became clear that Mike Richards was probably going to be named permanent host, and then of course was, I basically started off by just being curious about his early career and how he kind of got his start in television, because it was pretty widely known, and he has said publicly many times that he wanted to host in addition to producing. So I was curious about that element of it. So there were a couple main threads of the story that we published last week. One of them was his involvement in the search for the permanent host. Of course, you know, he emerged victorious from this process, which I think raised a lot of eyebrows amongst Jeopardy fans. And what I found from reporting is really that he was quite closely involved with just about every step of the process in ways that do absolutely seem like a conflict of interest. And then the second thing was, as I was kind of going back through his, you know, earlier shows and other things that he'd worked on, I came across this podcast that he hosted while he was the executive producer of The Price is Right, called The Random Show. And he hosted that for a year and a half. And over the course of that podcast, he made a lot of controversial comments. You know, he used sexist language and classist language and ableist language. He used some ugly slurs. He talked a lot about women's bodies and women's clothing. So basically my story was just kind of exploring those two veins.
So what's happening with Mike Richards right now?
Yeah, so this is, it's kind of a strange moment for Jeopardy, because while he stepped down at the end of last week as the host, right now Sony is saying that he's remaining the executive producer of the show. And he is also the executive producer of Wheel of Fortune, which kind of tapes next door and shares a lot of the same crew and has historically shared an EP with Jeopardy. So I think a lot of fans are questioning why, if this all these revelations were disqualifying to be the host of Jeopardy, they are not also disqualifying to be the executive producer of Jeopardy, who really is kind of the number one at the show. So yeah, it's a strange moment. And of course, Jeopardy had just begun taping its new season that will begin to air in mid-September. So he taped 5 episodes as the new host of Jeopardy. We don't know if they'll try to kind of retape at least the hosting portions of that. Jeopardy's supposed to be back in the studio this week, taping more episodes after they canceled production on Friday. And we don't know if he will be the executive producer. I suppose Sony says that he will be. And we don't know who's going to host. They've said that they're going back to guest hosts, but we don't know who's going to do that.
Okay. For those who are not involved in the making of TV, help people understand what it is that an executive producer does so they will understand sort of what Mike Richards' involvement, at least as far as we know right now, is going to continue to be on Jeopardy.
Yeah. So at Jeopardy, the executive producer, like I said, is the number one. He's the boss. So the EP at Jeopardy really kind of just runs every other component of the show. So, you know, they will start off their morning going into the daily writers meeting, where this kind of like fun writers room, these people who've been to, you know, working on Jeopardy and writing clues for Jeopardy for years and years, decades in some cases, to go over the material for the day's games and, you know, kind of critique the phrasing, and the host will be there as well. And then once they actually start taping the show, the executive producer sits at that kind of offstage judges table that you sometimes see the host look over to when there's an uncertain ruling, basically calling the shot. So, I mean, there is a director, there is a stage manager, but this is the person with a connection to the host, the earbud in the host's ear, and really running it. And also the executive producer does these sort of big picture things, like figuring out what the next big tournament is going to be for the show. So, I mean, they really do run everything. And I think what makes this especially kind of interesting and to some degree concerning is that the executive producer is intimately involved with the host. And so whoever the host is, I mean, as we go back to guest hosts, but eventually they will name a new permanent host once again, the executive producer will be that person's boss. So you can imagine how awkward and strange it would be for that person to be Mike Richards.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's so helpful for folks to just understand that kind of constellation. So let's go in just a bit more around his selection or announcement as host. Fans of Jeopardy are not necessarily like fans of other kinds of television watching. They're very invested in this show. How did fans and viewers respond to the initial selection?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, it is a very, very intense fandom, and Jeopardy fans feel very, I think, protective of the show. There is this kind of like, this is my Jeopardy, and it's an interesting community with a lot of former contestants in it. So there was naturally going to be some suspicion of this host search process ending with an internal candidate being named host. I mean, the joke everybody was making was that it was a lot like Dick Cheney leading the search for George W. Bush's vice president and being named the VP himself, or the candidate anyway. So, you know, sources within Sony have said that Richards removed himself from that search process after he became a candidate himself. But what's become abundantly clear is that as the show's EP, he had an enormous amount of influence over the process, even if it was just the day-to-day of what the other guest hosts were doing, because Richards was giving all of these interviews over the course of most of a year about how the guest hosts were auditioning. These were live auditions, and that viewers should tune in and, you know, vote for their favorite and make themselves heard. And so where it gets complicated with Richards as the EP, even if he was no longer sort of in the room with the Sony executives trying to choose the next host. I mean, he was the person in the ear of that host telling them what to do. He was the person who trained that host. He was the one, it's come out, that chose which episodes from that host's run to send on to focus groups. So Richards and Sony both talked a lot about how the studio was using data and analytics to make the choice for the next host. But in fact, a lot of that data is kind of suspect, knowing how involved the EP was as he became a candidate.
It's so helpful, again, to understand sort of the ways in which, if it's meant to be even sort of a version of research, right, that is definitely a stacked research project. No one is blind to the hypotheses there. And I guess part of what I want to go to here is that it is exactly the kind of thing that goes against Jeopardy's brand, right? That the whole idea of kind of what makes Jeopardy stand out is that, yeah, we all know it's entertainment, we all know it's a show, but it feels more genuinely attached to facts, to curiosity, you know, to fact checking itself, even sometimes live on air. How might this whole debacle impact our sense of trust about Jeopardy?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I think the show is in a really tough position right now. It was always going to be impossible to replace Alex Trebek because nobody is Alex Trebek. I mean, he was the only person who was what he was, and they're very aware of that, you know, whoever comes next is not going to be what he was to audiences and to contestants and to the staff of the show. But I think that yes, there is something of a fracture of trust now. I mean, I think there was a lot of suspicion after Richards was named host, but with what's come out over the last couple of weeks, it's clear that, you know, this process, if not exactly rigged, was at least not totally honest. And I think the concern for Jeopardy is that this show has occupied this very unique space in television and in pop culture of being this kind of pure place where facts matter and nothing else matters. And, you know, you come, you do as best as you can on that stage. And as a viewer, I mean, you were watching and you were playing along on your own couch. And to kind of lose some of that objectivity to suddenly be controversial, this show that for so many years never has been, kind of threatens Jeopardy's place in pop culture, I think.
So you were talking about the impossible task of ever replacing Alex Trebek, and I think that seems right. But we do know that Alex Trebek, I mean, he was deeply aware of his own mortality at the end. He was fighting with everything he had, but we also know that he understood that that fight could not go on forever. What did Trebek talk about in terms of the future of the show, both in terms of hosts that he might have wanted to see come next, leadership, any of that vision?
Yeah, I interviewed him a couple of times as I was working on my Jeopardy book, and I asked him, "What do you want for the future of this show?" Because, you know, at various points as he entered his 70s, he would talk about retiring and talk about, you know, wanting to, you know, sit back and enjoy himself and not work anymore. And of course, you know, he ended up passing away as he was in the midst of filming a season. But certainly he himself had thought about what Jeopardy would be like after him. And I think to a great degree, he didn't want to be the person anointing the next host of Jeopardy. I think he knew that that was going to probably be a difficult transition for Sony just because it's such a major change. I mean, he had been the host for 36 and a half years and was this kind of larger than life iconic figure, really the face of Jeopardy. But he did, of course, name a couple people that he thought would be at least good candidates. And that was Alex Faust, who is the play-by-play announcer for the LA Kings hockey team, and Laura Coates, who is a CNN legal commentator. And I think a lot of fans over the last couple of weeks have been calling for them to finally get a shot. And we don't really know if they were ever contacted to be guest hosts the first time around. So as Jeopardy re-embarks on this guest host process, this audition process, I think there's certainly a lot of interest in seeing one or both of them come in, because Trebek, who had so much experience, certainly thought that they were capable of it.
It's interesting. What do you, any sense of sort of what were the particular either skills or talents or just sort of what they communicate via the camera that made them interesting candidates for him?
Yeah, well, I think a comparison I've heard a lot in the case of Alex Faust is that being the host of Jeopardy really is a lot like calling a sporting event. There's just so much happening and you're refereeing in the moment and you're watching people kind of go up and down. You have to keep track of all these different storylines and you're constantly the one sort of dictating the action, even though, of course, it's the players answering these things. It's a very involved thing for the host of Jeopardy, especially compared to other game shows that don't really demand as much in the moment. I think Laura Coates is interesting, and this sort of speaks to what Jeopardy and Sony were doing with the guest hosts the first time around, where I think Trebek certainly felt that having experience as a broadcaster was critical. He himself got his start as a broadcaster in Canada before he moved down to Los Angeles and started doing game shows. But that kind of, you have both the kind of the television reps of saying complicated words and moving through, you know, breaking news and refereeing all those things in much the same way that a sporting announcer would.
They were non-obvious choices to me. So I think that it's interesting to kind of understand even how Trebek's mind worked around that. How do you see the future of Jeopardy? Will this moment with Mike Richards be sort of, I mean, again, you make the point about 36 years, a show that is beloved, right? Even by its kind of theme music, this sense of, you know, like attachment over all of the things that we can think about that have happened over the past four decades, and yet has been largely sort of drama free. Presumably, Jeopardy has a deep well of goodwill that it can draw from, and that this will be sort of momentary. Or do you see this as maybe a real turning point that maybe Jeopardy actually can't outlive Alex Trebek?
Well, I think that there is a lot of concern among fans and the Jeopardy staff that this has really imperiled Jeopardy as a show, as an institution, as, you know, just this holder of this kind of very unique place in American culture, where it was this unimpeachable thing that was not controversial. It was just the facts. And now that's just not the case. On the other hand, I think it's true that Jeopardy has this massive, massive audience. I mean, it is a ratings juggernaut, and it has been for a very long time. And, you know, for Sony, it makes Sony a whole lot of money. And I think that, you know, those audiences are not going to vanish overnight. You know, even with this controversy and whatever they do next, ratings have declined a little bit since Trebek's death. They're down about 10% year over year. But they're, you know, people still love Jeopardy, and that hasn't changed. And so I think that so much of the game is the same and will stay the same. The writers are all still there. That has not changed. And it is still those 61 clues. And I think that, you know, for all these bumps, Sony does at least understand that there is some magic to the Jeopardy formula. And I think we will have that going forward.
Claire McNear is a staff writer at The Ringer and author of Answers in the Form of Questions, A Definitive History and Insider's Guide to Jeopardy. Claire, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, for months, there was speculation about who would replace beloved longtime host Alex Trebek, who died of pancreatic cancer in November 2020. Now, that speculation is going to continue, and we asked you about this, and y'all definitely had a name in mind for who you'd like to see.
I would choose LeVar Burton.
I think LeVar Burton is the clear choice. He's a national treasure.
My top choice by far is LeVar Burton.
LeVar Burton would be a great host.
If it's not LeVar Burton at this point, you're really just missing out.
LeVar helped so many of us as young kids enter into a love of reading and learning, which dovetails beautifully with the insatiable curiosity that you need to do well on Jeopardy.
All right, y'all, that's Tuesday's takeaway. Glad you're along for the ride. Now, before we go, how about some more of your slice of life audio moments? Okay, remember, we've been asking for a few moments of your day in audio form. Email to us as a voice memo or a voice recording to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. We got this one from Jim in Syracuse, New York. Take a listen. I know that stuff to listen to, but check out the story. Jim tells us this is the sound of the cranky hydraulic lift on an adapted wheelchair van that has been around the block a few times. I borrowed this van from a friend recently when my family's adapted van was stolen from my driveway. The event was stressful for me and debilitating for my wheelchair-using son. But folks came out of the woodwork to offer us support and assistance, and we did get our van back. Whenever I hear this banging noise, I'll smile and remember how lucky I am to have good friends. Keep on coming, folks. An audio snippet of your life, and tell us a little story about it. Email the recording to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. And a special thanks to the Amber Hall, our senior producer and longtime takeaway warrior. She's headed off for a new adventure and still making all sorts of amazing audio for you. She'll always be Takeaway family, though, and we'll miss her like crazy. Best of luck, Ambo. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway. Meet me back here tomorrow.